Find other great podcasts like this one at podmoth.network.
Welcome to the Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy podcast. I'm Declan, the son.
And I'm Jane, the mom. This is the podcast where we talk about brutal crimes, bizarre occurrences, and get you drunk with cocktails themed around one of our stories. To lighten things up, we'd like to end our time with a chaser. Please keep in mind some of our stories might be upsetting to young or sensitive ears.
We love hearing from our listeners, so feel free to contact us by email or social media. You can find our contact info in the show notes for this episode. If you'd like to support us through Patreon, you can find us there at Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy Podcast, or use the link in our show notes.
This is not a test. This is your emergency broadcast.
Curfew is in full effect. Everyone lock your doors and don't answer after midnight. Early on Wednesday episodes are about to be released.
Tell us about your encounters with Early on Wednesday.
Ladies, this is Natasha with Cryptids, Creeps, and Conspiracy. You guys are great. I mean, you're funny. You're very interactive with people, both on the pod and through social media. And your guys' detail in your episodes is great.
I think it's pretty awesome.
Stacey and Lavender keep you very engaged in the topic.
And you guys make me laugh throughout my day when I'm having a crappy day.
You heard it here first. Stay safe out there, ghouls.
I'm Mandy.
And I'm Avery.
We're the hosts and creators of Thick Thighs and Creepy Vibes.
Join us as we take a deep dive into the macabre and the unexplained.
Listen every Wednesday as we take you on a chilling journey that transports you to all corners of the Great White North.
Let's boot those Sunday scaries while we take a rip into the harrowing tales of the haunted and the supernatural phenomena that defy explanation.
So grab your ketchup chips.
And your Caesars. And make sure to
creep it real.
Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for joining us today.
Yes, it's always good to hang out with you guys. You too, Mom.
Yeah, same to you, bud. What story are you going to be telling us today?
I've got the story of Maura Murray.
I know that name, but why am I blanking on it? I know that.
I'm really hoping we didn't do it before. I didn't look and see if we had already done it. So I'm really hoping.
I don't think so.
Okay, cool. What is your story today?
I went spooky again and I did another haunted location. So,
okay.
We'll see. This is a more local to us haunted location. It's on the Oregon coast. So I've driven past it several times, but I've never been to it. But now I really want to go, of course, because it's fun. So
yeah, I will not be joining you, but I'd like to hear the story.
What if we go during the daytime?
I don't want to bring anything back with me. I'm good.
Okay.
That's what poltergeists do, right? They follow you home or something.
I think so, but I don't know that there's any poltergeist. All so, I mean, we'll get into it, but the stories that I have are pretty, you know, not scary, nothing. I didn't find any, like, you know, weird, creepy heads hanging from the ceiling or anything like that kind of stories. So we'll see. Anyway, but it's about the Hasita Head Lighthouse, which is between Florence and Newport. It's 12 miles north of Florence.
Okay, over by me then. About an hour and a half away.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
Exciting. And to go with the story, I brought the foghorn cocktail because lighthouses have foghorns.
I do declare.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't even think about that. Oh my God, that's fantastic. Foghorn Leghorn. That's yeah. Oh God, you got me on
had
that
to say
one.
It.
That's
had
great.
To say it.
Yes, perfect. Perfect. Well, this is not about a giant rooster.
A funny chicken.
Okay. Right. Yeah. This is about foghorns that are on a lighthouse. But you know, I suppose if we had done like a giant chicken or giant rooster story, we could have used it for that too. It would have been
true.
It would have
been worked for that headless chicken that lived for like 5 years after it got its head cut off or something.
Ew. No. Yeah. Oh, that's would that fit brutal or bizarre or gross? Just gross. You need to have
gross.
A gross category. Yuck. Okay, so this cocktail, the Foghorn cocktail, is made of 2 ounces of dry gin, 1/4 ounce of fresh lime juice, 4 ounces of ginger beer, and then ice and lime wedges to serve. The steps are to fill a highball glass or old-fashioned glass with ice, pour in your gin, and then lime juice, top with ginger beer, lightly stir, and then add lime wedges as a garnish. And so
sounds
I guess
pretty tasty.
Yes. I mean, anything lime and ginger beer is right up my alley. And I've been combining a lot of weird things with those, like apple cider and caramel vodka. And I mean, there's nothing, I haven't had anything bad alcohol wise. When you combine it with lime juice and ginger beer, it always tastes good. I'm sure there's some, I mean, if you put like Jaeger with it, that would probably be gross. Or maybe what's something that we really, really neither one of us likes? I don't know. Cognac, maybe. Brandy, because it's sweet.
I don't know if I've ever had cognac. Well, we did that one drink.
Yeah.
I think I replaced mine with whiskey, though. I don't remember.
Maybe. I think I kept it, but yeah, I don't know. Anyway, I'm ready to try it if you are. Shall we?
Well, I'm ready to give it a try. Yeah.
Our ice clinking. Here we go.
Yeah, not bad.
It's not bad, but the gin, the dry gin, really does make it dry. So,
yeah, ginger beer is pretty dry itself, too. So.
Yeah, I think for me personally, I might put a splash of simple in it. Just a little splash of grenadine in it for the sweetness, and then it would make it pink. I don't know.
True.
But it's good. I think I will definitely finish that glass. It's worth it.
Yeah.
Okay, are you ready for some history of this lighthouse? Because of course,
sure.
We have to start there. We can't just dive right into the ghosty, spooky stuff.
I gotta figure out why it's haunted.
Because it's old.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, it's old.
Something's old enough. Someone's had to die there before.
Probably. I mean, there are some problem with some of the deceased activity there was some of it. There weren't a lot of records that were kept because it wasn't directly like the lighthouse keepers. We'll talk about it later, but basically they didn't keep records if it was the families of the lighthouse keepers. So they don't really know a lot of information, but it's got a pretty interesting long history. So if you've ever seen a lighthouse picture of the Oregon coast, it's likely been a picture of the Hasita Head Lighthouse. This lighthouse is said to be one of the most photographed locations on the Oregon coast. There's quite a few lighthouse pictures that are not of Hasita Head, of the other ones, but this one is a tall cylindrical building. Obviously aren't most of them. And it's sitting along the very rocky coastline of the Oregon coast. So for people who don't know what the Oregon coast looks like, it's a lot of rocks that drop straight off into the ocean. And it does not look like an inviting place to hang out. And it's cold and it's often gray and dreary. And yes, we say the Oregon coast. It's never, I don't think ever anyone's called it the beach. You call it the coast. When you're from
there's
Oregon.
There's like a couple spots where there's like an actual beach, but most of it right. isn't really walkable without like shoes.
Right. And I mean, we've been to several places like Gold Beach. Obviously, Gold Beach has a beach. There's beaches in Newport. There's beaches in Florence. But no one from Oregon ever says, I'm going to the beach. Unless they're going to a beach in California. If they're going to the Oregon beach coastline, it's the Oregon coast. That's just the way it is. You don't call it anything else. The lighthouse building itself is 56 feet tall and it features a red roof. There are a couple of nearby smaller buildings on the property as well. Originally, there was a head keeper's residence as well as a duplex that was used for housing the assistant lighthouse keepers. The lighthouse sits 205 feet above the Pacific Ocean. It is located 12 miles north of Florence, Oregon, which is kind of center of the state, basically. It's like central. The light feature is the most powerful of all Oregon lighthouses and shines a light that is visible for 21 miles and shines for 8 seconds every minute. The bluff that the lighthouse sits on was named Hasita Head in 1862 after the Spanish explorer Bruno de Hasita, who had sailed along the Oregon coastline in 1775. He was just checking out the coastline and looking to see what he'd find. And apparently people knew him for that. So when they named this portion of the coast, they named it Hasita Head after him. The lighthouse tower construction was completed in August of 1893, but due to some delays in shipping of the lighting mechanism, the light itself wasn't lit until March of 1894. Maintenance and running of the lighthouse was done by three lighthouse keepers, one main keeper and then two assistants. In the beginning, the light was a giant oil lamp, which required constant cleaning of the glass in the tower, as well as moving the oil from the ships that would bring it in, because it's on the coastline, so, you know, easy to ship that way. They would bring it into the building where it was stored. Because of this isolation, Hasita Head had its own post office and one-room schoolhouse. It's a pretty remote area of the coastline at the time. One teacher taught the lighthouse keeper's children as well as areas ranchers and farmers' children. In 1916, a larger school was built for the children that went there. There was a whopping 14 children that were attending school there at the time. Could you imagine 14 children? I mean, we don't even have class sizes. Yeah. That's it. 14 kids in the entire school. No.
But they got a good education. I don't...
Yeah, no kidding. In 1930, the extreme isolation started to improve when the Oregon Coast Highway was constructed between the town of Yahats and Hasita Head, a distance of about 14 miles. The lighthouse became electric in 1934, which meant fewer lighthouse keepers were needed, so the main keeper's house was torn down. On the grounds near the lighthouse was the duplex that I mentioned, and that for many years that was occupied by the assistant lighthouse keepers. But since they tore the main one down, when they cut back on the number of keepers, they kept the duplex, and that was where the lighthouse keeper lived in. Only one lighthouse keeper was necessary until it became automated in 1963, at which time the final lighthouse keeper, Oswald Alec, retired. Once the lighthouse became automated and a keeper was no longer required, the property started to fall into disrepair.
So this lighthouse is on an island, no?
No, it's a point. It's not an island itself. It's actually on the coastline, but Hasita Head does jut out a little bit more than the surrounding area.
I know I've been to one of the lighthouses on the coast. I don't remember which one, and I think it, if it's the haunted one, that makes sense, because I had the
spooky stuff happen to
pan of my Infiniti ripped off in the parking lot.
Really?
Yeah, my ex was driving the car and hit a bump too hard and had to listen to it rattle all the way home.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
Yuck. So during World War II, the property and its buildings were used as military barracks. To help with maintaining the property, the buildings were leased to Lane Community College in the 70s, and that was for a very small amount of money if they agreed to help keep the property in better conditions. When I say small amount of money, like, the sources said it was either a dollar a month or a dollar a year or something.
Jesus.
Very, very minimal like that, because they were like, this shit's falling apart. If we lease it to you and you use it, you just got to keep it up. And they were like, that's cool. Mm. Yeah. Okay. Basically free property, right?
Yeah.
The school did some modifications to the duplex to allow them to conduct some classes there. It was eventually listed on the National Registry of Historic Places in 1978, which helped protect the property and allowed it to be rehabilitated. In 1995, the keeper's house was leased privately from the Forest Service and is now a bed and breakfast, which is where a lot of these stories come from, of the haunted activity. Yes. With the long history of the lighthouse, it's no wonder that it's been reported to be haunted. It was even named the creepiest place on the Oregon coast by HGTV. So, kind of cool. The most commonly reported ghost is a gray woman seen wearing a Victorian-style dress. No shocker there. It's probably a white dress.
Always a white dress, isn't it? They never wear red.
There's always a lady in white. I mean, come on. She is known as Rue, her name being acquired in the 1970s when a group staying at the keeper's house were playing with a Ouija board. She is not known to be threatening or scary in her appearances, but many have heard sounds like sweeping movements coming from the locked attic, which would definitely be creepy. It's not known who exactly Rue was, but she's believed to have been the wife of a lighthouse keeper. The theory of why Rue is still there is also up for debate, but many believe her daughter drowned and died on the premises, and Rue is there trying to find her daughter. As I said before, records about the lighthouse keeper's families were not kept, so confirming her identity or the story of what happened and why she might be there is essentially impossible. So nobody really knows. However, there is an unmarked grave on the hillside on the property that has never been disturbed. So they think that that grave might be one for a child, and that's why Rue is there. But because they didn't keep records of a lighthouse keeper's wife or family living there, they don't know even if anyone by that name lived anywhere close by. They just don't know. One of the first publicized ghost stories occurred in 1975 and was published in a local paper. A workman reported having been in the attic cleaning the glass, and he noticed something odd in the reflection of the window. He turned to see an apparition of an elderly woman. The sight terrified him and scared him from the house for several days. Upon his return to the property, he refused to go back into the attic, resuming his work from the outside of the building. During his work, he accidentally broke a window, which he would only fix from the outside because he was like, I'm not going up there. You can't make me. I'm not doing it. So he repaired this window from the outside, but he didn't tell anybody about it. That night, the caretakers of the house reported hearing strange sounds from the attic. They claimed it sounded like someone was sweeping glass across the floor. And the next day they went up to find a nice, neat pile of broken glass that had been swept
up. It was creepy.
Yeah. Very. That's just, yikes. But they hadn't known that that window had been broken because he didn't tell them. So that was a little bit of a surprise for them. Guests over the years have reported seeing ghosts in different locations around the house. One guest reported feeling a presence climb into bed with her, which remained there for several hours. And no, I think we talked about this with the Santa Maria Inn. If ghosts are climbing into bed with me, that might be my tipping point. Yeah. I might be like, okay, we're done. I'm definitely not down for that. I don't want to spoon a ghost. Ooh. Yeah. No. No ghost spooning.
No.
No, thank you. Some guests claim items have been moved around their rooms when no one was in there, while others report items going missing, but then turning up later. So, like, their slippers get moved from one side of the room to the other. Something that they're looking for just vanishes, and then the next day it's like, or a few hours later, it's back where they were looking for it originally.
Freaky.
Which is creepy, but also would piss me off because I already forget shit enough. Don't be moving stuff around on me and then putting it back. Like, if you're going to take it, just take it. Don't put it back because then I'm thinking I'm an idiot.
I think I'm crazy.
And I didn't see it.
Yeah.
Exactly. I don't need any more reason to think I'm crazy. Housekeepers have also noted feeling like they are being watched and noticing body impressions in the bed as if someone just sat there after they just made the bed. So you make your bed, you turn around, and there's a butt imprint of somebody sitting on the edge of the bed. Of course, there are common reports of strange smells in empty rooms, particularly of an older style perfume. Windows are mysteriously found unlocked right after someone purposefully locked them. Disembodied voices have been heard inside the house. Some caretakers have brought their pets to the property and have reported that the pet will often sit in the basement and like stare at a location, like staring in the corner as if they can see something that the humans cannot see.
Which, okay, to be fair though, dogs just stare at like random shit. Like,
true. And so does the cat. I mean, I don't know if all cats do it, but several cats that we've had, Hemi sits there and stares at the ceiling in the house all the time. I don't know why. She's special. She might be missing a few screws upstairs. So who knows?
Definitely.
Or maybe she's seeing something, but I'm going to go with she's just weird.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So maybe what the animals are seeing is a gray ghost cat that's also been reported seen roaming around the building. So not just ghost humans, but ghost cat too. The bed and breakfast doesn't allow children to stay there who are under the age of 10. So when guests have heard children playing in the halls, it's rather weird, especially when the hallway is empty.
That's weird.
I don't know. I think ghost kids would probably creep me out the most out of any kind of ghost stuff. Ghost kids are just, I'm not down for that. Of course, the area wasn't first occupied by the lightkeepers. There were Native American tribes living in the area prior to the building of the lighthouse. Native American culture often discusses shadow people, similar to what we might call ghosts in modern society. There are several stories of shadow people being seen in and around the area when the land was being disturbed by road construction. So, you know, any kind of construction and disturbing the earth often stirs shit up. And so people often reported seeing shadow figures and shadow people. The lighthouse does offer ghost tours around the Halloween time. So if you don't want to spend the night with the ghosts and be spooky in the bed and breakfast, you can still go and potentially have a spooky experience during one of the ghost tours.
Mm-hmm. That sounds cool.
Okay, so if you don't want to go to and stay in a ghosty hotel with me, would you go on a ghost tour where it was like other people and...
Maybe.
Maybe. Okay.
Maybe.
Yeah. Okay. That's something. That's something.
I just don't want to bring anything home.
What if we found like a witchy
made like a
person.
Ghost condom? Like something that a ghost condom. So you know you didn't bring anything home.
Right, right. Well, I was gonna say there's probably like crystals and
water.
Rocks and you know, protective things that you could do to take with you to maybe prevent you from bringing home your ghost STD that you're worried about.
That's basically what it is. I mean, you didn't ask for it. It's just hanging around causing problems.
Maybe you'll get rid of it, but maybe you won't. I mean, you can't treat...
It depends on the ghost.
Right. You can't treat a poltergeist with antibiotics.
Oh, gosh. That's funny. Oh.
All right.
All right, let's talk about Maura Murray. So, Maura was born on May 4th, 1982, and was the fourth child of Fred and Laura Murray. Maura did good in high school and graduated from Whitman Hansen Regional High School, where she was a track star. After high school, Maura was accepted into the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, studying chemical engineering. But after three semesters, decided West Point ultimately wasn't right fit for her. She transferred to University of Massachusetts Amherst to study nursing. In November of 2003, Maura admitted to using a stolen credit card to order food multiple times and was set to have the charges dismissed prior to a three-month period of good behavior. On the evening of February 5th, 2004, Maura was working her security job on campus when she got a phone call from her sister, Kathleen. Kathleen had been in rehab for a few months due to alcoholism, and when she called Maura, she told her that while her fiancé had picked her up from rehab, he caused her to relapse when he drove her to a liquor store.
What a dick.
Yeah, so same day, just right from the rehab to the liquor store.
Wow. Not cool.
At around 10:30, her coworkers reported that she broke down in tears and went mostly unresponsive, just kind of sitting at her desk. Her manager decided to take Maura home around 1:20 a.m., and when she was asked about the event, she replied with two words, "My sister," and then closed the door to her dorm room. 2 days later, Maura's father arrived in Amherst so the two could go car shopping and afterwards had dinner with a friend of Maura's. Maura dropped off her father at his hotel and borrowed his car for the night. Maura drove to a party on campus around 10:30 that night and reportedly drove home around 2:30. About an hour later, Maura drove her father's car into a guardrail, causing roughly $10,000 in damages.
Oh,
which
wait a
to
second.
A Camry, that's basically totaled.
Yeah. Okay. So was it $10,000 just to the car or also to like the guardrail?
just to the car. I saw a calculation of about $16,000 today. Wow. Yeah.
What year was it?
Early 2000s.
Okay. Yeah. I'm surprised that didn't total the car.
Yeah. The responding officer wrote an accident report, but did not run a field sobriety test and drove her back to her father's hotel room. At 4:49, a phone call was made to her boyfriend on her father's cell phone. Later that morning, when Fred had learned of the damages to his car, and that the damages would be covered by insurance, he decided to rent a car and drive Maura back to her dorm room and continued his trip to Connecticut. At around 11:30 that night, Fred called Maura to remind her to get the accident report from the insurance company. On Monday, February 9th, she searched up a MapQuest directions for the Berkshires and Burlington, Vermont. At about 1 p.m. that day, Maura emailed her boyfriend saying she didn't feel like talking to anyone but promised to call him back later that night. She then called a condo that her family had vacationed at but did not end up renting it. And about 1:24, she emailed her manager and told them that she would be gone for a week due to a death in the family, which turned out to be false.
Oh, okay.
Classes that day had been canceled due to a snowstorm. Maura packed up her 1996 Saturn with some belongings and drove away from campus. She then stopped at an ATM on campus and withdrew $128 from her bank. She then stopped by a liquor store and picked up about $40 in alcohol, including a box of Franzia, some vodka, and some liqueur. At some point after this, she stopped by the Registry of Motor Vehicles and picked up an accident report form. After all her errands were run, at around 4 p.m., Maura left Amherst along Interstate 91. A few hours later, around 7 o'clock at night, a woman reported a black Saturn had crashed against the snowbank along Route 112 in New Hampshire. She initially reported a man was inside the car, but later said this detail was false.
What?
A bus driver who lived nearby spotted the crash and pulled over. He said that he saw Maura walking around and offered to call the police for help, to which she resisted and said she already called AAA. However, AAA had no record of her call.
Okay.
Another driver reported driving by the crash at about 7:37 and saw a police SUV parked near the Saturn. The driver stopped and got out to see if they needed any help, but didn't see anyone in or around either one of the cars.
Okay.
This conflicted with police reports that stated police didn't arrive to the scene until 7:46. Yeah. The police reported that when they arrived at the scene, the Saturn had impacted with a tree and smashed the front end of the car, making it impossible to drive. The car was locked and red stains could be seen inside the car that resembled wine, and the driver had, she was nowhere to be seen.
Okay.
Inside the car, police found an empty beer bottle, the box of Franzia, and some personal belongings, but what they couldn't find were Maura's phone, credit cards, and the rest of the alcohol she had purchased. At around 8 o'clock that night, a driver about 4 to 5 miles from where Maura's car was found noticed a young lady jogging down the highway, but did not report it to the police until about 3 months later when he got news of Maura's disappearance. And he like went back and looked at his paperwork and was like, that was the day I saw the lady running around the street.
Hours? How many hours later?
Around 8 o'clock, so about an hour after she had crashed.
Oh, okay. All right.
Still a decent amount of ground to cover.
Yeah.
4 to 5 miles in an hour.
Yeah.
He said she was jogging though, so I don't know.
Yeah.
At about 8:49, emergency services arrived with a fire truck and a tow truck to clear the scene and tow the car to a local garage, where it was discovered that a rag had been shoved in the tailpipe, which, according to movies, that, like, shuts the engine off, but I don't think that's accurate. Like, I did some digging around, and it's like, that wouldn't really do much. Like, mechanics use it to find exhaust leaks, and that's about it.
Okay. But,
Maura was declared as missing at 12 the next day, like, so right around noon. Fred was contacted by one of Maura's sisters about the disappearance and called police, who told him a search by Fish and Game would be conducted the following day if she was not found. Fred arrived before dawn the following day and helped in the search. A tracking dog picked up her scent but lost it after about 100 yards, which led to police to believe that she'd gotten into another car. Police initially believed that Maura had gone out here to commit suicide. However, her family dismissed the concept, saying that she was fine. Her dad had dinner with her like the day before and she seemed fine.
What? Why would they jump to that conclusion? It seemed like there was a lot of
police fumbling in this case from everything I read.
I hate that.
Yeah.
I hate that.
At around 5 that night, Maura's boyfriend received a voicemail from an unknown number, and he believed that it was the sound of Maura sobbing.
Oh.
Yeah. Because he was traveling. I think he was in Oklahoma, and he was traveling to the police station to get interviewed and stuff like that.
Wow.
That call was traced to an American Red Cross.
Oh. Yeah. Okay.
Super weird. And that lead goes nowhere. Like, ooh. It's... Anyways.
I don't like
10 days after her disappearance, the FBI came involved and made the search nationwide. In November of 2005, a man made a post on a blog dedicated to Maura's disappearance, stating that he saw a black backpack matching Maura's bag in a bathroom at a rest stop about 30 miles from where the car was found.
Okay, wait a second.
Okay.
A black backpack?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Like, I have a black backpack. I'm sure most people probably have a black backpack somewhere in their house.
Yeah, and unless it has like something specific,
patches or stickers on it or something, right? Yeah,
to distinguish it. Ooh, I saw a black. It's got to be hers. It's a black backpack. Huh. Oh, fuck off! I don't know how many black backpacks I've owned in my lifetime, but it's been multiple.
Yeah,
yeah.
Senior Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Strelzin. I'm going to go with that. Strelzin announced that law enforcement was aware of the backpack, but did not disclose if it had been tested forensically at all. Around this time, a man approached Fred and gave him a rusty knife and stated that his brother used to live about a mile from where Maura's car was located and acted super strange following Maura's disappearance.
What?
Yeah. The knife was given to state police for testing. However, the results were never released to the public. So, we don't really know.
Mm.
The New Hampshire League of Investigators, a team of 10 retired cops and detectives, took up the investigations in 2006. Cadaver dogs led them to a home about a mile from where Maura's car was found and alerted to the scent of a cadaver in the closet of the home.
No.
The house belonged to the brother of the man who gave Fred the knife.
No.
Yeah. A sample of the carpet was given to the police. However, the results were also never released to the public.
No. I don't like this.
Well, you're not going to like this.
Great.
In April of 2019, when the home came... In April of 2019, when the home came under new owners, a search of the house provided little to no information, and the case is still unsolved.
Of course it is.
Yeah.
Dude.
Yeah. Sorry for doing another unsolved one.
Quit. Quit with the unsolved. I don't like it.
It's just, there's so many weird things about that story. Like, in my mind, all the evidence points to that guy who had the cadaver dog search his house, but
it definitely makes me wonder, like, are they, did they not release the information about the, you know, checking forensics in the closet because there was nothing? Or are they holding it back because there's something and they're waiting for more conclusive evidence to charge this guy?
Well, you'd think if there was nothing, they would say that. I mean.
Right. But maybe.
So it has to be the latter. I mean.
Maybe they think if they tip their hand on saying that there was nothing or there is something, you know, maybe they're going to lose this guy. It sounds like he's their prime suspect.
Yeah.
But maybe they don't have enough to conclusively, you know, yeah, reasonable doubt and all of that in a trial, and they're waiting for more. Ugh, I don't like it.
Well, do you have a chaser to make things better?
I do. My chaser is a watch recommendation from Apple TV. It's the show called Shrinking, and it has Harrison Ford, and we started watching it recently. It's fucking hilarious. It's so good. The main character is the, why can't I think of the name? From How I Met Your Mother, the tall guy, married guy. My brain is.
Oh, Jason Segel.
No. Great. Now I'm going to have to look it up. Stand by.
Tall guy from How, isn't that Jason Segel?
No, not Segel. Stand by.
Jason Segel?
You could Segel.
Did I pronounce it wrong? Jason Segel. I was thinking the other.
Yeah. Jason Segel.
Dorky guy.
Yes. And now I have to go and look at what the frick his character name was on How I Met Your Mother, because it's driving me.
Is it Marty
mad.
Or something like that?
God, he was in Forgetting Sarah Marshall. He's been on so much.
Yeah, he's a good actor. I really like him.
Marshall. There we go.
Marshall. Mm.
He's like the main character, but there are so many good characters in this show, and it's all about, he's a therapist whose wife died.
I think I saw a couple episodes of this.
Dude, it's so good. It's so good. I know you don't typically do shows, but it is worth it because it's just funny. The stuff that the characters get into. My favorite part, absolute favorite part, was they're in the street talking to the neighbor, and the neighbor's like this nosy bitch. And the neighbor's husband is leaving for work, and the neighbor wife is standing there, and the bitchy neighbors named Pam, and the neighbor husband Derek says hi Pam, and his wife goes, don't be nice to her, we don't like her, and without missing a bit he goes, eat a dick Pam, and then drives off.
That's funny.
It's the best. Absolute. Just
that sounds like a good show. Yeah.
He's my favorite character. Same with your dad, because we've talked about like who's the best character, and we both agree it's Derek. He's got like no big part, but the shit he says is pretty good. So highly recommend.
Have to finish that, I think.
Yeah.
Well, my chaser is a snack recommendation.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, so I don't know. So you know, like Lay's does the like submit 3 flavors for our new year. And
they haven't been doing that lately.
I think they. I don't know if they like make it a challenge anymore. But I saw like a pack of 3 that were like different. Not a pack, but like 3 different ones that were new. I tried the. They had a Nashville hot chicken one, and that sucked ass. It wasn't good.
I thought you liked that one. It's pretty bad, huh?
But I found a new Pringles flavor, which I feel like you don't normally see, but it's Carnitas Tacos.
Really?
And it tastes just like a Carnitas taco. Like, I don't know how to describe it. It is like porky, like fatty. It's got the same spice as Carnitas. It's so good.
I love it.
If you find it, I would recommend you guys try it if you like tacos.
Yeah, and you're really picky about your tacos and also about your snacks, especially if they are supposed to taste like something else.
Yeah, like the hot chicken ones. Those sucked ass. Yeah. It was not good.
Yeah.
The Lay's Nashville hot chicken chips, skip those and get the Carnitas tacos from Pringles.
Have you tried the Lay's Cajun Spice?
Those were pretty good.
Those were pretty good. They're not like super spicy. They're not like hot, but they do have that like kind of blackened spice flavor to them. I liked them. Of course your dad didn't, because he doesn't like anything that is not just a plain.
Yeah.
He's
true.
He just like his snacks are very basic.
Yeah.
And he doesn't like more than like two flavors. If there's competing things, he's like, that's too many flavors together. You can't have that.
Yeah. He's a weirdo. So,
definitely. Definitely.
Well, I think that brings us to the end of today's episode. Thanks for joining us again, everybody. I enjoyed hearing your haunted lighthouse story, Mom. I have to go check that out on a tour or something.
Yes, we should go do it next year, maybe.
Yeah.
For Halloween.
Yeah.
For funsies. All right. Nice chatting with you, bud. Love you.
Yeah. Love you too.
Bye.
Hey, friends. Thank you for supporting our podcast. Please share our show with your brutal and bizarre friends. Give us a boozy follow on your favorite podcast platform. If you're feeling extra generous, we'd appreciate a 5-star rating or review as well. But maybe do that sober so all the letters are in the right place.
You can find all our contact information in the show notes. We love hearing from you, and if you're interested in helping us stock the bar for our future boozy episodes, you can find our Patreon link in the show notes as well.